Hello and welcome to CIFAR Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gonser.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cflar and on Twitter at cflarbigcats.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
For today's show, we're going to explore a little bit of the spirituality around working with big cats. And to do so, we're going to invite on a special guest. Our guest today is William Colachico, who has been a volunteer at CIFAR for over 2 years. You might know him as our master of ceremonies during Member Day events. He has been an ordained monk of Theravada Buddhism and currently holds 2 bachelor's degrees. One in psychology and religious studies. He's recently completed his master's in Asian studies with a focus on religion of Asia. He's recently also published a book called Everyday Meditations, available on Amazon and on his website, everydaymeditations.com. Welcome to the show, William.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So, William, what actually brought you to CIFAR? How did you find out about CIFAR?
Well, it was actually a pretty spontaneous, serendipitous thing where I was just hanging out with some friends one day, and this guy just started talking about how there was this place that had like 50 lions and tigers and all this other stuff. And I was like, I immediately jumped on it. I was like, what? So I think the next day I went on the website and applied to be a volunteer.
And so how did that play into the kinds of studies that you were interested in?
I had an interest in big cats before that time, based on my spiritual experiences, because the tradition that I was ordained in has these forest monks that would actually live in the forests in Thailand, which back 100 years ago had many tigers. So they would actually use their encounters with the tigers in their practice. And I read many books about that. And so I think it drew me even closer to my love of big cats.
Interestingly enough, there's been a lot of talk in fields about anthrozoology. It's becoming recognized as the study of how people and animals interact. And Theravada Buddhism, the sect that you have been ordained in, is one that has this practice that's going back far, far beyond the time frame when we know of it.
As far as, you know, taking it a slightly different way, as far as the time going back, I've been researching recently about, for example, the Sphinx and how, you know, it's half man and half lion. Even in other religious traditions like Rastafari and the Abrahamic ones and the Lion of Judah, you know, I think, you know, almost every major religious tradition has either lions or tigers, big cats affiliated with it. And recently, you know, the research I've been doing, there's many scholars now that think the Sphinx is even older than originally Egyptologists thought. So older than 4,000 years, think maybe even 10,000 years predating what we think of as Egyptian civilization. So this link between spirituality and big cats could go back even way further than we thought.
Interesting, because we've talked about this on and off throughout the show about the experience of being on the ground with the cats and how it is a very impactful experience, even if you may never come into physical contact. You immediately took an interest. You jumped in to become a volunteer. What was it like when you finally had that first impact, that moment where it became real?
It was amazing. I mean, Every time that I'm there, I just amazes me at that I'm actually that close to the cats and their powerful presence. You know, I think that's what we're talking about here is the cats their presence is so powerful, you know, and the fact that you can have a relationship with an animal that's that powerful, it's such a great dichotomy, you know, of like danger on the one hand because they're so deadly, but at the same time, you can feel love from that animal. Just the sense of awe, I think, relates directly to spiritual life, because whether you're talking about God or prayer or you're talking about enlightenment with Buddhism, you have to have that joy in the sense of awe in what you're doing, because that's what brings that intense sense of, you know, happiness or wonderment to what you're doing. And I feel that, you know, every time that I'm around the cats.
So tell us a little bit more about Theravada Buddhism. You were at one time an ordained monk in that?
Yes. Theravada Buddhism traces itself back all the way 2,500 years back to the time of the Buddha, which most Buddhist traditions do. It's founded upon the Pali scriptures, which is a language that scholars think is close to the language that the Buddha taught. It's very related to Sanskrit. Theravada Buddhism, I love it. It's great. There's many scriptures and many monks. It's spread all around the world now. You know, there's a temple here in Orlando. There's almost a Theravada temple in every state in the United States. It can be pretty simple. You know, based on just the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and all of the what we think are the original teachings of the Buddha. And it's all based around clarity and mindfulness, leading to trying to increase your happiness in life and decrease suffering. So it's all pretty relevant to the human experience.
You mentioned Four Noble Truths. Are those easy to explain or more complex?
You know, just like everything, there's always debate. But the first one is, you know, where there is life, there is suffering. And then the second one is, you know, that craving causes suffering, basically. You know, there's the suffering that comes just with physicality and having to age and die. But most of our suffering is we create ourselves mentally. So craving is what causes suffering, basically. And then there is a way out of suffering is the third one. And then the way out is the Eightfold Path, which is basically pursue wholesome mind states and wholesome intentions and activities, which is what leads to suffering and peace, and steer away from unwholesome things, which is like greed and anger and delusion. So it's pretty simple in that way, basically avoiding negativity and pursuing positivity, you know.
And how does your experiences out at CIFAR play into all of that?
Well, in many ways, it plays into that, because that's one of the things that drew me into this and provided one of the strong links between the two aspects of life, between the cats and between my meditative practice, is because the cats, you know, they have that sixth sense, you know, that the people talk about. So if you have a lapse in mindfulness, you know, or if you're having a bad day and you're not on point, they will let you know. They don't provide much room for you know, not being on point and being right there with them. So
they're forcing you to focus in that way.
Yeah, it's basically a mindfulness check, you know, because if you're not mindful and you slip just for a second, that's all it takes, and something serious could happen. I mean, usually, thankfully, it's not too serious, but it's like they'll let you know, you know.
Our guest has also recently published the book Everyday Meditations. I've actually picked out a passage here that I thought might be interesting to read in the context of what we've been discussing. So if you wouldn't mind reading a little bit of Inner Alchemy, the first paragraphs that you've got there.
Okay. Inner Alchemy. The origin of our suffering is within us. It doesn't come from outside ourselves. Most of all, the Buddhist teachings, as well as those of most other spiritual teachers, tell us to direct our attention into ourselves, into our own thoughts, actions, and speech. The teaching is to study our own mind and put our growing knowledge and wisdom to good use. It is about deep awareness and acceptance of the present moment. We meditate to cultivate the ability to see our thoughts, emotions, habits, and reactions as they arise, deepening more and more acute perception and more subtle levels of awareness as the meditation is developed. So, what we focus on is the fact that we can willingly change our reaction to and perspective on anything. The human mind has incredible power. This leads to some really terrible things, and it leads to some really great things. The point is that we can use all these teachings as tools of perception to eliminate suffering. The foundation of the practice in performance is to just watch. Stay present as the watcher or witness of your internal state and mental events. As we dwell in the present moment, we can get in touch with this just seeing. No judgment, no identification. Just seeing.
That's a great passage. You know, the more I think about some of the experiences that we have had out at CIFAR, and like you described, you have to really be there and you have to really be present. It's extremely amplified somehow being around the big cats. I've had some new people who will tell me that their experience has been one kind of adrenaline, almost a subtle, quiet fear that they can't really describe, but it keeps them from feeling hungry. It keeps them from feeling tired. It makes them do things that they ordinarily physically would say that they could not do. And it all kind of stems from this concept of the subtle winds that are kind of blowing around us as we are working in such an environment.
You know, that's sort of what I was talking about with the cats forcing mindfulness to be present with you. Those forest monks in my tradition, they would use that fear to develop their mindfulness. And, you know, it's a very poignant mind state, as you were describing. So it's there. It helps you to work with your mind. You know, pretty much all traditions of Buddhism, that's what it's about, is having mastery over your own mind. So it's a great tool because it's a very powerful thing. You know, people may feel fear, but you know, there's many emotions that could be involved when we're working with these cats.
Is that part of a meditation kind of state when you're out there trying to be focused to make sure that you're mindful of what you're doing around the big cats?
Oh, definitely. We're caring for the lives of those beings, so that's one part of it. And then staying focused, and it's definitely a meditative thing.
Well, your book is called Everyday Meditations. So do you actually have examples or exercises in the book for people for everyday meditations?
Yeah. One of the first chapters, we start off and do a basic guided introduction to breath meditation and body meditation, which are kind of the same thing. And just teaching people how to, you know, focus on their breathing as a meditation object to calm the mind and get focus going on.
So is it more about, as well, we've mentioned before, self-awareness seems to be the main focus.
Mm-hmm.
And bringing yourself to think more about your own actions and your own feelings and how you can control them?
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it's kind of a gradual process for sure. But it's like once you start that practice and you actually start to see more and more into your own mind. And then that way, like you said, you can have more influence over your own thoughts and your own emotions and your own intentions, which can lead to, you know, a better life and more happiness and less suffering.
Does there seem to be a disconnect between the need for a certain amount of externality versus a very internal dialogue? It sounds like this is the kind of practice that would lead to a very rich inner life, but the impact on the world still has resonance.
Oh yeah, for sure. Because, you know, first of all, when you're able to take care of yourself, then that spreads around you to the outside world. But yeah, there's a lot of dialogue on that, which is, you know, taking that internal practice out into the world. Yeah, that's, you know, where a lot of the work is done. Some people incline to one or the other, you know, doing more activism and work in the outside world. Some people incline more to the inner world, and then it's the real mastery of it is in bringing those into balance. But I think it definitely helps taking up the internal meditation practice to help you out with all your activities directed outward.
That's interesting because you mentioned the inner world. I associate the word monk with someone that is more inner and not very expressive to the outer world.
That is part of it, at least for a certain amount of time until you kind of develop that mastery, is to go more into the internal world so you can, when you do come out and start to teach and start to, you know, take on projects or help other people, whatever it may be, then, you know, you're more balanced, you're more equanimous, you're more, your intentions are in your own control. But I don't think you can ever really 100% escape, you know, the outside world or dealing with things.
Our conversation with William Colachico continues in a moment. You're listening to CIFAR Sounding. Listening to CIFAR Sounding with hosts Simba Wiltz and Asla Gonzer, talking with guest William Colachico, co-author of the recent book Everyday Meditations. Have you ever found that some of the work that we've done out at the facility has actually been challenging to some of those core beliefs?
Not really. I don't think so. I mean, challenging for sure, but not necessarily challenging to, you know, where I'm coming from with spiritual life or anything like that, because, you know, whether it's challenges day to day with, you know, on the ground doing things, dealing with other volunteers, negotiations and creating schedules. I mean, it's all, the inner life is always involved. You have your own mind, so you're always, you know, dealing with your own mind in relation to whatever it is. So that's a big point about the spiritual life, is that it's always going on. You know, you never really get a break from your own mind.
True words were never said. Wow. Now, having said that, obviously, you know, that means that there is, of course, that struggle between the inner and the outer. And have you found yourself personally tested by that at all in relationship to just kind of how you have to live your life in order to survive?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's one of the things. I mean, it's one of the more hardcore aspects of the tradition that I come from, is that they actually do meditation on food, meditation on death, which I could read a passage from my book about it, but that's another thing that attracted me to taking care of the big cats, is that we have to feed so much raw meat to these carnivores, and it's like a lot of people can't handle it, as you know, because it could get pretty down and dirty, you know. Mm-hmm.
What's the meditation on food? I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, as we were just alluding to, it's like we have to eat to survive, and you have to work to eat. So it's like we were talking about the awareness, and it's all about being aware of those truths of life. This is one of the tougher things that people have problems with. I actually did master's research on this because at one of the temples in Florida here, they teach these more taboo types of meditation on food and on death, because it's like a lot of people don't want to look at that. You know, your food looks good and smells good, it tastes good, but not for long, you know. So it's like, and that relates to our work with the cats. So it's a meditation on some of those harsh realities of life.
So you said there's a passage in the book that relates to that?
It's a chapter called Feeding. Everything that exists in the phenomenal, conventional world that you and I know has to feed off of something. Contemplate this. Watch TV shows with arguing intention, and those are the seeds that are watered and with polluted water in your own mind. Expose yourself to peaceful, wise, inquiring, and positive material, and that's what will manifest more in your mind and life. Let us practice and touch a non-feeding state. We may have started to do something, thinking that it was harmless, but over time find ourselves habitually seeking refuge in something that has become a poison, If we realize we have an addiction, we must take careful steps to stop feeding our addiction. We may have to wean ourselves off whatever we are addicted to. The practice of meditation and open awareness will gradually help open us to the possibility of freedom. It may take more time than we would like, but be patient. Have compassion for yourself in times of struggle. Realize that many other people have and will experience what you are experiencing. The path towards touching a non-feeding state starts with feeding off of wholesome food of mind, body, and speech.
A non-feeding state. I like the term there.
Yeah, that's actually one of the descriptions of enlightenment, is a non-feeding state. That's one of the few non-feeding states.
That's a fantastic description, especially because it may be translated into the idea of us being takers and versus givers. And we talk about in environmental conservation impact, how much impact we have on the environment. And by using feeding in this terminology, it really takes it away from the simple act of putting food into mouth to what you're using to sustain yourself, whether that be your environment or other things.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that ties into a whole nother aspect of our work, like you were just saying, which is the, unfortunately, the dwindling population of all big cats because of globalization and industrialization and consumerism.
With the non-feeding state enlightenment type of thing, obviously you have to eat to live. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that there's more than just food that feeds you.
Exactly.
Where is there ever an example as powerful as working around the tigers, I would think, with that? You're talking about an apex predator that is built to feed itself under some of the most strenuous conditions that, you know, exist on the planet in some cases. And yet there is this extreme of peace that they also hold, where they can be still for 18 to 20 hours a day and then explode into this raw natural power so that they can take their food. It's almost like having to hone your skills around the true professionals in the art of this kind of living.
It's interesting you mention that. What comes to mind is that whole, the discussions we've had in the past about anthropomorphizing the big cats. Can you really look at those behaviors and say that cats are happy?
That's a great question.
Well, coming from my tradition, like from the Buddhist point of view, it's every sentient being can have happiness and suffering, you know? Yeah, because they have a nervous system, you know, and they feel pleasure and pain. You know, humans obviously are at a slightly, I don't even want to say higher level, but it's like we can have, you know, more levels of cognition. You know, I think animals are pretty close.
That seems to be a fundamental natural rule, that you move towards things that are pleasurable and you move away from stimulus that's noxious or otherwise dangerous. Taken to its extreme, given our mental faculties and the other tools that people have, clearly that presents a unique problem, because you can exist in those states in extremis for a long period of time.
Well, that's the big difference, I think, is that when something happens to us as humans, we struggle to explain it, understand it, try to figure out why this thing happened to us, and it keeps us in a negative state far longer than any animal would be had something negative happened to the animal and then that negative thing being removed from their environment. They go back to their more normal state much quicker than a human would.
Yeah, I've had that reflection before too, is that we can, you know, make ourselves suffer because of our own mind so much, like there's versus animals, which I don't think have that same type of mental rumination of self-suffering that can lead to self-annihilation as we've seen in humans.
Switch the topic a little bit on you to talk about your personal experience, your volunteer experience. Tell us one of your favorite cat stories that you've had in the two and some odd years that you've been doing this.
Mm.
I love this question, because this is the ultimate meditative question. How aware, and does that awareness leave the facility and come with you? Yeah. Because obviously you're very aware when you're there. But how much of that is functional awareness and how much of that is meta awareness?
As far as particular stories, I don't really have any, but it's more the long term, like you said, the meta experience of being there and developing relationships with the cats, that's the most touching thing, really. You know, I more think of individual cats and just kind of my meta experience with them over time, like whether it's Wynn, who's a white tiger, or Kukla, who's kind of a diva, as you know. She could be hissing at you 1 minute and then loving all up on you the next minute. Fortunately for me, I haven't had any regretful experiences which would stick out. But so it's really all positive experience stretching over the time, and it's been amazing.
Surely you've been marked at least once.
Oh man, the other day I got sprayed directly in the face. Like directly in the eyes.
Oh, that doesn't sound good.
No, it was bad.
Well, it makes me wonder, was that not being aware, or was that something where it was more of an opportunity to meditate on the meaning of being sprayed?
I think it was a combination of the two, but definite lapse of awareness.
Now, you're a pretty tall guy. How'd they get you in the face?
I think they got pretty good aim.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So this was a deliberate marking of your face.
Oh, indeed.
I see.
So who got you, and tell us how that happened.
I think it was Nathaniel. Because, you know, when we... Nathaniel, as some in the audience may know, Nathaniel is a tiger which lives with two lionesses. So it's a very unique situation. When we have to clean their enclosure, we shift all of them into a smaller enclosure. So it's a tiger, Nathaniel, in with two lionesses. I don't know what he was trying to tell me with that, but...
I don't know. I think it's part of his habit. He knows that we're going to have a key stuck in the lock or something, and I get it too. Every time he wants to turn and spray once he's in there.
Oh, in the shift cage?
Once he's in that shift. It's such a small human area. It's such an easy target, I guess. It's just his thing. After he shifts, he wants to spray.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. Because he knows you can't get away because you're in the hallway there.
We've had so many hilarious stories about that one, where we've had people who've had they've been trying to unlock the door, and they see him turning, and their key is stuck in the lock, so they can't pull away, and suddenly he gets him.
So Nathaniel has learned that is the spot in which you are trapped.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
How's that for mindfulness in a tiger?
Definitely.
Yeah, like I was saying before, is they're much smarter than some people may think. I mean, they're there. Any little gap, they know about it.
And take advantage of it, clearly.
Yeah. If you had infinite time and resources, what future would you like to see with the cats?
Oh, man. I would just like to see their natural habitat preserved and restored so they can live a more natural life and just be free to at least restore the population and have big, you know, big areas for them to thrive in. But, you know, obviously with the work of people like yourself and this whole organization that all of us are involved in, I think there is the possibility for things to turn around. So, yeah, I mean, I love the cats, and I think that they have just as much right as any other being, you know, to survive and thrive. And I was actually thinking about this when it comes to God. You know, there's so many people in the world that believe in God, and to take a species to the brink of extinction the way that we have with pretty much all the big cats is, I hate to use such words, but it's like slapping God in the face, because he created them, did he not?
That's a good point, actually, that slap in the face, that's a good way of expressing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's strong words, but, you know, I mean, they're I mean, yes, they could be deadly creatures. I mean, they're apex predators, but they're beautiful, you know? I mean, they're just like all other beings. They have the right to live and survive and thrive and be as they are.
That was William Colachico, co-author of the book Everyday Meditations. Part 2 of our interview with William will continue next week.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
Send us your thoughts. You can get us on email via contact@cflar.org.
Tune in again next week for more discussion. My name is Asla Gonser.
And I'm Simba Wiltz. Thanks for listening to CIFAR Sounding.